This is MSO Sports. I'm Rick Moore. We are back now with our basketball insider, Mike Grenier. And Mike, one good day in a row. It's sunny out here as we record. How are you?
Good, good. We hope that the projection is sunny for the Celtics playoffs. How's that for
you? Well, I like that. Oh, a sunny projection. We'll see what your thoughts are. Oh, by the way, I forgot who you picked in the Final Fours in college in March Madness. Did you pick the winners?
I know. I must have picked South Carolina women and UConn men. I mean, I was...
Okay.
Both of them were deserving, obviously. UConn really dominated the tournament. Even against Purdue, a team that has a big man, obviously, and good all-around talent. You know, they pretty much dominated that game, won by 14 or 15. And of course, South Carolina, I hated to see Iowa lose. Caitlin Clark is that great, certainly a generational player. But South Carolina was just a powerhouse team with a much stronger, more physical team, you know?
Tell me about UConn, Mike, because, you know, the women are always up there, but the men now 2 years in a row, and from what I read, every single tournament game they won by double digits.
Right, exactly. I forget what the total spread was for the six games they played, but it was pretty high up there, and they pretty much handled every team. The word that I used to describe the final was relentless. Mm-hmm. They play a relentless style on both sides of the floor, offense and defense, and they just wear you down with their... They're so structured on offense and so skilled, and they just get easier looks by working so hard at it. And then defensively, they cover every inch of the floor. They don't give up any easy baskets. They're really well coached by Darren Hurley, who's kind of a cocky guy, but he's a great coach. And, you know, I could see why players will enter the transfer portal to go there next year, because they're a winning bat. They've won it six times since 1999, the entire tournament. And they're on a roll right now, 2 years in a row, and who says they won't be good next year, you know?
Do they keep players, I mean, between the transfer portal and going to the NBA, a lot of these schools, they have these flashes, and then the kids are gone.
Right, exactly. But as far as I know, the only player from UConn is the big man, Klingan, C-L-I-N-G-A, is just a sophomore, 7'2". I think yesterday, Friday, he just declared for the NBA draft, and I don't know where he projects, top 10, I would think. He wouldn't, you know, you can always pull back and say you're not going to go to the draft, but right now he must have gotten word that he will be a fairly high draft pick. But he's a solid big man. He doesn't have great quickness, but he certainly was a pretty dominant figure, blocking shots as well as scoring.
All right, before we take a look at the Celtics and other stuff in the NBA, tell me what your thoughts might have been. I know Gary Larrabee is a good friend of yours, and he's a great colleague of ours. He wrote a story on the former Danvers high school basketball coach who's had incredible success. What's your reaction to that story, Mike?
Well, yeah, I mean, well done. Phil Stacey, the sports editor, put him on it because he said, you know what, let's take another look at John Walsh here, because when he came to Danvers, Danvers had literally a 50 or 60-year resume of losing, and sometimes losing 17 or 18 games a year. Occasionally they would make the state tournament, but they really had a losing program for a long time. And then John Walsh came in there, and he got right to the youth level basketball in Danvers, started going to all the games and picking out kids that he knew would be good players and encouraging kids to come out for basketball and sort of kind of just mentoring them in many different ways. And when they got to the high school, they gelled. I mean, they became a really good team in a matter of two or three years, and he won three state titles there. And then, you know, he leaves. He came to Central Catholic, which is a school just 3 or 4 miles from where I am here. And, you know, he had success there. He got into the state tournament but didn't win a state title. So now he went to Malvern Catholic Division II, and he's won two in a row. Or is it three in a row? He's won three titles overall, so that gives him six state championships, as he's still a relatively young coach. And he obviously has the magic touch in getting players to play together. I know that last year when Malvern Catholic won the state tournament, they won by an average margin of something like 35 or 40 points per game. Mm. Unprecedented. I had never heard of that. And this year, I know they had a two-point win in one of the state tournament games, but the rest of the games were blowouts. So, I mean, Malvern Catholic and people who follow Malvern Catholic must be ecstatic when they go to state tournament games, thinking their team's going to win by 25 or 30 and put another a championship banner in the hallway, you know? So he's done an incredible job at both Danvers and in the Central Catholic, even though he didn't win it there. And, of course, Malvern Catholic. I mean, six state championships That looks good on any coach.
Well, yeah. I'm going to go philosophical here, Mike, because I don't know that there is an answer. But in your experience, all covering all sports, all different sports over the years, when you come across a coach like John Walsh or like Frank DeFelice or
yes.
or any of those coaches who are so spectacular in high school, college, or whatever level, is there a formula for that, Mike?
Well, I think it depends what level you're at. I mean, obviously, if you're at the college level, you got to be able to recruit. And, you know, the kids you get at that age, they're mentally sharper. They want to do well, but, you know, they might not take to coaching as well as high school kids who kind of follow blindly if you're a good coach. It takes different personalities to be successful. I think any good coach is probably well-schooled, and not only just in the finer points of the game, but in motivation. You have to be a really great motivator. I don't care if you're at the high school level, the junior high level, the college level. You have to be a great motivator, and you have to have good assistants around you to implement a system that you care about and that you think is a winning system. There are so many factors involved, and I think, you know, the way you relate to players, all of that stuff is important. It's all part of I don't know if there's a certain given formula that works for every coach, but I think coaches do it in different ways. You can be successful in different ways. Some coaches can get away with really shouting at the – I don't know if it means shouting is the word, but being tough, it's sort of tough love type of approach. That can be a winning type of formula. Other coaches may be more laid back, but they have such a great knowledge of the game and they're able to implement a system. So I different personalities can do it, can win the games, and different personalities can be hard on players or easier on players and still win. So, you know, it takes all different types to be successful, and we've seen it at various levels all through the decades, you know.
Yeah.
John Walsh has had great – Jack O'Brien was around at Salem High School when he won with Rick Brunson, Jalen Brunson's father, and he had a tough approach, and they won a state championship there in 1990. And then, of course, he went off to Charlestown High School, and he won like three or four championships there. So he was able to do it, you know, with different kinds of approaches and at different schools to the way John Walsh has done it.
Yeah, that's really interesting, but you did hit on some commonalities there that I think are so important, and I hadn't really sort of quantified that. So that makes sense. I like that. Thank you for that. I learned something today.
Yeah.
Excellent.
You have great players. I think one of the things that you have to really have – I know that at Danvers, for example, John Walsh didn't have the greatest athletic players. He didn't have some kid move in from some other town who was 6'10". He won it with the kids from – downtown Danvers, you know, and they played excellent team basketball. He taught that way, and he was a stickler for it. And so they won games in a state tournament by 6 points, 4 points, 2 points, but because they were so well disciplined and coached by John Walsh that way, they didn't have to have super talent, but they played together, and that was the hallmark of those Danvers teams.
Mm.
I'm sure Gary Larrabee pointed that out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure Gary Larrabee pointed that out in his story about Walsh.
It sounds too that you're describing the prototypical Boston Celtics over the years. In that they may not have always had the best talent, although that could be challenged as well, I'm sure. But it's the teamwork that they do. And let's get to the Celtics. I want to start with Peyton Pritchard, because the one thing I've observed this year with Peyton Pritchard is that he seems to be able to, for better one of a term, read the room. He can go in with the starters and understand that, okay, he's not the show, but he can spark the starters. He can read the room. He can fit in beautifully and not lose a step. And then, like last night, when he's in with the reserves, he's the man.
He's the man, right? And even sometimes with the regular players, the big-time players, there have been parts of the game where he's the man. You know, Drew Holiday had to sit out a couple of games at the point guard position, and Peyton Pritchard played a lot of point guard, and he came through with some 16, 18, 20-point games. I love the way he's been attacking the basket, even against bigger guys, and he's able to stop on a dime and hit that little jumper from the foul line or even from the baseline. And, of course, last night he scored a career-high 31 against Charlotte, and he was like 14 for 22 from the floor. And we know he's an excellent three-point shooter, but He doesn't settle for the three-point shot. I mean, he's able to drive it. He's able to pull up for jump shots. He's been playing good defense. He, for a little guy, he gets a fair amount of rebounds. So I think that's a great sign for the Celtics as they prepare for the playoffs, because they know they can use him when Holiday needs a break, a few minutes here or there. I think that Joe Mazzulla can use him with great confidence, whether they're playing the 76ers or the Bucks or anybody else in the Eastern Conference.
His quickness is deceptive, too.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there was one point a year ago when he wasn't getting much playing time, he was hinting that maybe the Celtics should trade him and he'd better off it with some other team where he'd get more playing time. But, for, you know, the way he played out, guys get hurt, he gets more playing time, and all of a sudden he blossomed. This has been his coming out year. He's really blossomed, and to a certain degree, so has Sam Hauser. Hauser, obviously, he's not good off the dribble. He's not going to take it into the basket the way that Peyton Pritchard, a point guard, does. But obviously, he's gotten more confidence, three-point shot, and he's shooting it at over 40%, which is excellent for the NBA. So, you know, I think as the seventh or eighth guys, meaning Horford, let's say, being the sixth man or something like that, you know, as the seventh or eighth guys, Pritchard and Hauser are excellent fit right now for what the Celtics are trying to accomplish.
Would it be fair to compare Sam Hauser with Tommy Heinsohn?
Well, you know, in those days, they didn't shoot a higher percentage like they do today. They you know, Tommy Heinsohn was not an especially great shooter, and nobody took, like, so-called three. There were no three-point baskets, and so nobody needed to shoot from that far away. So it's hard to compare. But Heinsohn was just a hard-nosed guy. He had that line drive shot.
Mm-hmm.
If you roll films, I'm sure you can go to YouTube and look them up. But Heinsohn had that line. When he fired the ball, you never thought the ball would go in the basket.
It was like
Otani hitting a line drive to the outfield. You know, he took a line drive shot, but yet, you know, he had it down pat. That's the way he grew up shooting that shot, and it was effective for him in the NBA. And, you know, just the way Bob Cousy would take a set shot. You know, no one takes a set shot the way Bob Cousy, you know, just he'd need a couple seconds to set it up, and he'd just roll up one leg and look like he was, you know, kicking somebody or something. And he would take a set shot, and it would go in, you know. I mean, but those guys back then did not shoot at a high percentage of the way the players do today. They just did other things. It was a different approach to the game, you know. And, of course, Bill Russell was under the basket to clean up everybody's misses. I mean, that's why he would get sometimes 30 or 35 rebounds in a game, you know.
Well, what I meant was the size and the reliability that, you know, Heinsohn, if you need a shot, he's going to shoot it. I mean, they didn't call him Tommy Gunn for nothing.
Oh, yeah, and not only that, I think Heinsohn was certainly a superior rebound to Howell.
Okay.
Well, Howell was not asked to rebound.
All right,
Heinsohn
yep.
Was.
Yep.
Heinsohn was probably, after Bill Russell, the guy they relied on the most to get rebounds. I mean, I saw many a time where he'd get 22, 23 rebounds in a game along with, like, 37 points. You know, he was a great all-around player. I mean, he's a terrific player. I mean, he was a great teammate to Bill Russell and the rest of the guys.
Well, it's funny. I saw a picture of him on social media in a game from 1957 or 58.
Yeah.
And it's funny because, you know, you see him as this old white guy, is what we remember him now.
Yeah.
But he is way jumping way above everybody else's shoulders, and I cracked up over this. I you know, because I didn't watch Heinsohn. I watched. I did get to see Russell and those guys maybe once or twice as a kid.
Sure.
But I don't remember how really good Heinsohn was.
He must have learned that at Holy Cross, Rick, right?
Of course.
I mean, you think about it, right? Holy Cross, Cousy, and Heinsohn.
I know.
That's unheard. You know, that would never happen today, of course, because the upper-level Division I players end up playing, you know, Kentucky or Purdue UConn or whatever, Arkansas and Duke and North Carolina. You don't see guys from Holy Cross. It's a nice school. They have good basketball teams, but it's a different level of ability these days, you know?
It's funny when you say Kentucky. I mean, I see John Calipari's name in the sports, and I just want to turn the page. I don't even want to look at it.
Well, you know, he made the ultimate egotistical statement this past week when he was hired by Arkansas. He put off the press conference till Tuesday or Wednesday, and then he's quoted as saying, out of respect for the national championship game Monday night, I didn't want to take away the spotlight from Purdue and UConn.
Oh, God.
I was almost choking at that.
I'm glad I didn't see that. No, I turn the page. I just go to something else when I see his name. I just, yeah. You know, I'm a UMass grad, so, you know.
Right.
Oh, my goodness. All right, so should we – no, let me rephrase that. How should we look at the two-game losing streak that the starters were playing in other than they're kind of bored at the moment?
Well, yeah, I think bored is a good way to put it. But the problem – it's okay to be bored and the game is being meaningless – but you somehow still have to engage and play the game. And to me, they were disengaged in those two games, certainly against the Bucks and the Knicks. They didn't hustle for rebounds. They didn't get to the so-called 50-50 balls. I was so impressed with how hard the Knicks played. And, of course, the Bucks, who were trying to improve under Doc Rivers, and they just had not played well. And they badly wanted that game, and they just destroyed the Celtics. But those teams were really playing hard on those particular nights, and the Celtics didn't match the intensity, even 50%, I thought, of the Knicks' intensity the other night. Naturally, the Knicks are vying to finish even second in the Eastern Conference right now, depending on what happens in the final games on Sunday. But the Celtics, to me, developed some bad habits, Rick. I think you saw it, and anybody who watched the Celtics regularly, I think, in the last couple of weeks in particular, with the best record in the NBA wrapped up, Joe Mazzulla sent the starters out there. I mean, one night he might rest Jaylen Brown and Tatum would play, and the next night Tatum would rest and Jaylen Brown would play, and he sat out Porzingis for one game, he sat out Horford. But for the most part, the starters played, and I put quotes around that, only because they didn't play that hard. Now, in the game the other night that they lost to the Knicks, I thought the only guy who made effort on defense and tried to hustle and get offensive and defensive rebound was Jason Tatum. I thought Tatum put out the effort. He didn't want to lose that edge that you need into the playoffs. I think he realized it better than any other player on the team. And I thought he put out the effort. I didn't see Jaylen Brown match that. I didn't see Porzingis match that. Horford, being an older guy, you want him to kind of take it easy before the playoffs. But even Drew Holiday, you know, had some off-shooting nights there the last couple of games. And I know they extended his contract, and that's great. But I didn't think he was going all out 100%. And that was surprising because he goes all out 100% 99% of the time, okay? So I just think they developed bad habits. They weren't attacking the rebounds. That concerned me. Can you just turn it back? That's the age-old question, whether it's football, basketball, baseball, a team that gets to rest for a week or two or has the best record wrapped up. Human nature, I think, is to like, okay, I'm not going to try to, I'm going to try to avoid injury in these last couple of games, you know. I'm not going to go all out 100%. And you just, it's human nature. It's like you said, Rick, the human condition. These guys naturally, like you said, get bored and they get a little lazy. And I don't know that you could turn the faucet back on that quickly. And, you know, when you look at the Celtics situation, you know, they could possibly play Philadelphia or Miami. I mean, there's different scenarios that can play out in the next 24 hours. But if they're playing Miami or Philly, you know, they're a little bit unlucky in a sense that Joel Embiid just came back a couple of weeks ago, and he's ready to go. And he could score 35 and get you 15 rebounds on any team. And Tyler Hero, who's a great scorer for Miami, he was out for a couple of months with an injury, and now he's suddenly back and scoring 20, 25 points a game. So it will be no picnic in the first round if they play either of those two teams.
It seems to me, as we maybe now project into the playoffs, that the Celtics team defense is probably more important than their ridiculously great offense, because they can allow someone like Jokic or Doncic or whoever to get his 40 points and his 30 rebounds or whatever the hell it is.
Right.
But if they shut everybody else down, they're going to win.
Right.
How do you look at that? To me, defense is the big thing going into the playoffs.
Yeah, it is. I agree. And the Celtics, especially with Porzingis coming on so strong this year as a shot blocker, it's even better than it was the previous 2 years when the Celtics had a shot at winning it all. So that's why they have their best shot this year, because Porzingis makes such a big difference on individual defense as well as team defense, because with him back there to block shots, you know, if Tatum overplays his guy and Jaylen Brown overplays his guy, you know, Porzingis is there to swat away the shots when the guy drives. And, of course, Jrue Holiday is a terrific defender. So you have that going for you. But it has to be in sync. And that's what I thought was missing in the last few games of the season. Can they regain that? Well, yeah, they can. They have to make a conscious effort to regain that, what I call the mental toughness and that awareness that you have to get back right into the swing of things here. There's no taking it easy in the playoffs. If you lose game one, you're in trouble already, you know? So they have to regain that defensive intensity right away. And, you know, they'll need some not-so-subtle reminders from Joe Mazzulla, the coach. But as a team, they have to say to themselves, okay, we have to kick it into high gear again. So it concerns me only because they didn't do it the last couple weeks of the season. They were so sporadic about playing defense. And offensively, they were just chucking away threes, which really, that was infuriating to me. The way they were just chucking up threes, and when they were shooting 25% on threes as a team, you say to yourself, take it to the basket, for goodness sake. You know, I watched Denver play, and I don't know percentage-wise how many threes they take compared to the Celtics. I'd have to look that up. However, they don't take as many threes as the Celtics, not nearly as many. And that's because Jokic is in there flipping the ball to guys driving to the basket, and they get higher percentage shots. It's a different style of offense.
But
they have a unique figure there in Jokic, who undoubtedly should win the MVP award. So it's a different approach to the game. But the Celtics, they're a three-point shooting team, and we have to live with that. But they do have Porzingis settled into that. When he starts to post up at the foul line or closer to the basket, they're a much better offensive team when they dump the ball into him and he takes those types of shots rather than taking a 29-foot three-pointer.
How much of that is put on the Celtics' individual egos or the coach?
Well, I think it all plays into it. I think here's what I like, though. The Tatum, I mentioned a minute ago, he seems to be the key guy in terms of reminding the guys that they have to go hard and play hard and take it. Because I know about a week ago, Tatum was actively campaigning for Jaylen Brown to be named a first-team all-defensive player. That's the first time I've ever heard him talk that way. I think Tatum is a real leader this year, and I think he's going to set the example, and those guys are going to have to follow. I think he's become the bellwether of the team in the sense that you're going to follow my lead, and on nights when the threes aren't falling, he is the one that's more likely to take it to the basket, and therefore the other guys have to follow. I just think right now Tatum is seeing this as the best opportunity he's had in his career to win a championship, and he's going to do everything possible to make the guys follow him. And these guys aren't dumb. I mean, Jaylen Brown wants a title. Porzingis knows he's got a great opportunity. Jrue Holiday just signed a new 4-year contract. He wants to win a couple of titles. So the incentive is there. They just have to play the game the right way. And that's where, you know, Mazzulla has to do the job this year. I mean, last year he came in at a bad time. He got the job only one day before. You know, that's an old story now. He only got the job a couple days before the season started. Well, now he has a full year, a full two seasons under his belt, and he should have those guys ready to go. And unfortunately, Rick, they don't play for about a week or so because that play-in tournament, which is so convoluted, will take a week to play. The number 10 seed has to play the number 9 seed. Then the number of the 7th seed plays the 8th seed. And so you can't project who really quite what the Celtics are going to be playing here because there's so many things that can happen in the final regular season games tomorrow with teams shifting from 3rd to 4th place and 5th place to 6th place. And you can't really prepare until these play-in tournament games play out, and that won't be until Friday or Saturday. So there's a lot to they'll be viewing a lot of film on these teams because they don't know who they're going to be playing.
Okay, so who's the biggest threat for the Celtics in the East?
I personally think it's Miami, the team that beat them last year. Even though you got Embiid back for the 76ers, and you know when you combine Embiid with Maxey, who's had a great year, and Tobias Harris is a great player, and Kelly Oubre, who's come on strong. I just think Miami, because of the style they employ, the way they run the ball, Jimmy Butler has that sort of that mental toughness that you look for in great players in the playoffs. Adebayo is a terrific big man, and of course Tyler Herro, who I mentioned, is a thorn in everybody's side when he's healthy, because he can get you, even coming off the bench, he can get you 30, 35 points. But I have a feeling that, you know, he'll be back in the starting lineup. And Kevin Love, who's been around since the Civil War, still playing, Rick. And, you know, I look at those box scores, and even he's got the gray hair and everything, and you say he should be out, you know, enjoying his yacht as a retiree. But he's still giving you a double-double. He'll get you 15 points and 12 rebounds, and he'll be a pain in the neck during the heart of the game coming off the bench. So, and you know, with the coaching they have, I just think they're a really dangerous, dangerous team for anybody to play. But the Celtics, you know, really have to watch out for that team, I believe.
Yeah, it's funny how some teams match up against other teams.
Yeah, exactly. And I think they seem to match up well with the Celtics.
Yeah.
Not that the 76ers don't, but I just think the Celtics would have a nice advantage over the 76ers. I just think they're a much more complete team than the 76ers. They have far more depth. The funny thing is, Rick, I'd rather have some of the teams that are in the upper level, like the Knicks and the Bucks, who haven't played well under Doc Rivers. I'd almost rather see the Celtics playing them in the first round, because I think Miami is a real tough matchup for the Celtics. Mm. Whereas I think, as good as the Knicks have been playing, they're not nearly as, in terms of depth, they don't have nearly the depth the Celtics have. And I think the Celtics would have, quote, a somewhat easier time against the Bucks and the Knicks, but they wouldn't be seeing them until the second round. The Celtics have to deal with probably Philly or Miami in the first round, or perhaps Indiana. The Pacers have that same kind of record right now as the Pacers, as the Sixers and the Heat. They could end up playing the Celtics in the first round, and that would be a far easier opponent for the Celtics in the first round.
All right. Final question, Mike, for this session. Is Jason Tatum the Celtics MVP this year?
No question. And you know, it's so funny, Rick. He's definitely the Celtics MVP because of his all-around skills, the way he's playing defense. He gets to the foul line, the leadership he exhibits on the floor. He still gets upset with the officials, but he's not as demonstrative as he was a year or two ago, where we get frustrated with virtually every non-call. He's definitely the MVP. And it's, the funny thing is, a month or two ago, on a national level, people were talking about him as in the conversation for the overall MVP. But I don't hear his name being mentioned as much lately, even though his play has not dropped off at all. You'd think he'd at least be in the conversation, although I think Jokic will win it in a runaway. I think Jokic is the easy MVP choice. But I think that, you know, all of a sudden, Tatum is not in the conversation nationally for the MVP, but that's okay. I think he's fine with that. He's going to make a lot of money in his contract, and he's determined, I think, to lead the Celtics to a championship.
I hope you're right, because I think his leadership has been what it should be. You know, we're old Celtic fans. We go back, and
right.
he has become a Celtic. He has his little moments when he has to dribble the ball
right. And
be the hero, but they're not very often.
Right.
And he's always out there. He always is out there giving everything. He doesn't take a day off.
Right, right. He kind of reminds you, when the Celtics won it in 2008, you know, I think of Kevin Garnett, of course, because of the intensity he brought to the table every single night.
Mm-hmm.
I also think of Paul Pierce, who at that point in his career had a long and productive career in terms of statistics, but he needed a player like Garnett to finish off the product. You know, he just needed a Garnett there to make the team more complete and to put it over the top. And of course, they had a great bench with guys like Eddie House hitting threes. This Celtics team here reminds me a little bit of that team, and Tatum is sort of the Paul Pierce of this team, with a little Garnett thrown in. He doesn't play. Garnett always looked like he was angry when he was playing. You know, he was that intense.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like Dave Cowens is the same way. And Tatum is a little bit more laid back, but he plays with great intensity. I just think he's taken a step forward this year, and he's carrying the guys with him. And I think him just saying about Jaylen Brown he should be first-team all-defense shows you that he wants to put himself out there and support his teammates and say, hey, this guy deserves to be on this particular All-Star team, or this guy should be sixth man of the year. I bet you he would campaign for Porzingis for some award,
mm-hmm.
you know?
All right. Finally, we've gone quite a while here, Mike, but I do want to mention Mike Gorman because he is one of my all-time favorite laid-back announcers who's just so with it. He's just on top of it.
And he's been that way since he was doing college games in the Big East, and you see him on ESPN, right, before he took the Celtics job. I think he's been with the Celtics for, like, 43 years.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Great voice, laid-back style, unlike many of the shouters that you see on ESPN or CBS or any game these days, knows the game, but he's able to describe the picture for you in few words. In a few words. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's the best style to go. Because when you're watching a game on TV, the action is right there in front of you. You don't need someone shouting at you the analytics of the game. And he's not into analytics. He's into saying what's happening on the court.
Well, what I've always wanted with announcers is tell me something that I don't see. Tell me something I don't know.
Right.
And I think Mike Gorman does that. He gives you the information, but I just think he's just done a great job, you know, and he's believable. He, as you say, he doesn't hype up stuff. He's certainly a Celtic supporter, but he's been I'm going to miss him, man. But I'll tell you, the new kid looks pretty good too.
Yeah, I agree. He will be missed by old, not just old school Celtics fans, but even the younger generations. In the last 15 years, have seen this new generation of players come in, like Tatum and Jaylen Brown and Porzingis and Drew Holiday. Gorman is just great. No matter what era of Celtics he broadcasts, he was great through the Larry Bird era in the 1980s and the Paul Pierce era, even the bad teams they had with Antoine Walker and all that. He's been just a tremendous all-around asset to the Celtics broadcasting team.
All right, that's Mike Grenier, our own basketball insider with MSO News Sports. I'm Rick Moore.